Welcome to Questions in Sustainability, a science-based podcast series that explores programs, people, and ideas in sustainability of food systems. I am Professor Paul Vincelli, and our guest today is Mr. Bob Inglis, who is the executive director of Republican.org. We'll hear more about that during the interview. And that is a growing group of conservatives who care about climate change. Bob and his wife, Marianne Inglis, have five grown children, a son and four daughters. They live on a small farm in northern Greenville County, South Carolina. And maybe we'll hear a little bit more about Bob's history, personal history and background as we go forward. This is actually Bob's return to Kentucky in 2013. He was one of the speakers, the excellent speakers we had on a forum on climate change, and it was entitled Climate Change Values, National Security, and Free Enterprise, held at the University of Kentucky. And Bob, welcome back to Kentucky. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me, Paul. It's terrific to be with you again, and it's great to be there in 2013.
Yeah, it was. We had a wonderful experience together and with everybody there. So Bob, I know that you have a personal history in the topic of climate change, and so maybe it would be interesting and valuable for the listeners to hear something about any aspect of climate change, how you got into it, et cetera. To understand the person behind the voice a little bit better. So. Start with that.
Yeah, and it is a little bit strange, isn't it, to have a conservative concern about climate change? Because this is a liberal cause, right? And so, apparently not, because here I am. But apparently it is actually conservative to care about climate. That's our point at republican.org. Right. But it does take some explaining about how in the world did you, Bob Inglis, a conservative, get concerned about climate? So it's like this. For my first 6 years in Congress, I said climate change is nonsense. All I knew about it was that Al Gore was for it, and therefore I was against it. And so, I admit that's pretty ignorant, but that's the way it was for my first 6 years in Congress. Then I was out of Congress for 6 years, doing commercial real estate law again in Greenville, South Carolina. Had the opportunity to run for the same House seat again in 2004. Mm-hmm. And that was the year my son, the eldest of our five kids, had turned 18. So he was voting for the first time. And he came to me and said, "Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment." His four sisters agreed. His mother agreed. That's a new constituency. You know, they can change the locks on the doors to your house. So very important to respond to that constituency. Mm-hmm. So that was step one of a three-step metamorphosis for me. And by the way, my son was going to vote for me no matter what, right? Yeah. He knew we could lose by one vote. And he was just starting college. It wasn't in his economic interest to vote against me. So he knew we were literally mortgaging the farmette that we live on in order to run for Congress. And so so he's going to vote for me. But what he's really saying, I think, was, "Dad, I love you. And you can be better than when you were before. So how about make this Inglis 2.0, the new and improved version?" So that was step one.
Yeah, I remember this story, and I like hearing it again, especially in the detail you're giving, because I remember it from all the way from our visiting together in 2013. So I've interrupted you, but I just wanted to share that and carry on, please.
Yeah, so it's a second step was going to Antarctica with the House Science Committee. And seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings. We can go in that if you want to. And then third step was another science committee trip and something of a spiritual awakening at the Great Barrier Reef, which seems odd, doesn't it, on a godless science committee trip, because we all know that all scientists are godless. Well, apparently not, because this Aussie climate scientist who is showing me the glories of the Great Barrier Reef and the challenge of coral bleaching, I could tell was worshiping God and what he was showing me. Mm. I could see it in his eyes. It was written all over his face without any words because, St. Francis of Assisi said, "Preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words." And so I heard the gospel that Scott Herron, that Aussie climate scientist who's now become a very dear friend, was preaching without any words. And later we had a chance to talk, and he told me about conservation changes he was making in his life in order to love God and love people. You know, he rides his bike to work, does without air conditioning in Townsville, Australia, pretty hot place, as long as his wife and three daughters will let him get away with it. Hangs the family's clothes out on the line. Mm-hmm. All to consciously love people coming after us. So I got right inspired. I wanted to be like Scott, loving God and loving people. So I came home and introduced the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. Mm-hmm. Probably not a very good political move to introduce a carbon tax, even though it was revenue neutral and border adjustable, in the midst of the Great Recession, when you represent perhaps it's one of the reddest districts in the reddest state of the nation. It did not go well. Mm-hmm. After 12 years in Congress, I got tossed out in a Republican primary, the runoff. I got 29% of the vote, and the other guy got the other 71% of the vote. So at that point, a foundation came to me and said, you know, Inglis, you're pretty unusual. An actual conservative, 93 American Conservative Union rating, 100% Christian Coalition, 100% National Right to Life, A with the NRA, zero with the Americans for Democratic Action, that's a liberal group, and 23 by some mistake with the AFL-CIO, the labor union. I was really gunning for a zero. They said, you know, actual conservative, who cares about climate?
Yeah.
Will you speak and write for the proposition? So that's what I've been doing ever since. It's now republicen.org. Mm-hmm. It's six of us facilitating community, just over 11,000. We probably need a zero on the end of that or two on the end of that number. Paul, that probably requires a zero or two on the end of our budget. But I'd love for any of your listeners to join us, republicen.org. You go there, it'll take you about 45 seconds, and that join button will follow you whatever page you go to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned your credentials in conservatism, because, you know, it's a verifiable fact, I think, that you can be represented as a conservative. And so thanks for, you know, for bolstering that with data. You have been a resident fellow at Harvard University's Institute of Politics, a visiting energy fellow at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment. This was back in 2012, and a resident fellow at the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics. And George Mason, and you're affiliated, I guess, with George Mason University presently. So you really have substantial credentials, not only in public policy, but in the world of academia and ideas. And I think you bring a lot to the table, and you describe yourself as promoting free enterprise action on climate change. So what does that mean? How does that play out?
Yeah, well, you know, it's like this. There are basically three ways to solve climate change, and I know that may sound a little bit simplistic, but really, there are three buckets the solutions fall into. The first is you can regulate emissions. Second, you can incentivize clean energy. Or third, you can price in the negative effects of burning fossil fuels. And so it's just really those three things. You can regulate it, you can incentivize it, or you can price it. So the regulatory approach doesn't come naturally to us as conservatives, you know, because we sort of break out in hives when you say the word regulations. But even if we weren't that way, even if we were inclined to believe with progressive friends that, you know, regulations are helpful and useful, we'd see the limit of that solution, which is, yeah, you can regulate emissions here, but you can't regulate Chinese emissions from here in America. Mm-hmm. And so those regulations could clean up local air here. We'll have less asthma admissions to hospitals. We'll have longer life expectancy. It'd be great. I mean, that would be a good and useful thing to do. The only problem is you're not solving for climate change. Because the reason that climate is such a devilish problem is it's worldwide. You got to get the whole world in on this. Mm-hmm. And of course, the problem here is in this first approach, you regulate here, they don't regulate there. Well, manufacturers pick up and move from here to there. When they get there, they emit more than they're emitting here because we're way more energy efficient than China is. So you actually go downhill on solving climate change. So second approach mm-hmm. is to incentivize clean energy. And if I were still in Congress, I'd be voting for some of these things. Some of this is in the infrastructure bill. You know, it's expanded credits for wind and solar, subsidies of tax subsidies for direct air capture. These are good things, and I'd probably be voting for them. But I'd realize the limit of this one, which is similar to the regulatory limit, which is, okay, so you can incentivize American corporations through the American tax code by giving them deductions and credits and exemptions, but you can't incentivize Chinese corporations. So what you would have to hope in this second position is that, well, early adoption here in America is going to make the cost of these processes and these products come down and make them affordable in other parts of the world. And that's a good hope. We've seen it in the case of cell phones. It worked there. But here's the difference. In the case of a cell phone, there's 7 billion people around the world that would like to have one of those in their pocket. Mm-hmm. In the case of clean energy technology, there are probably 20, 30,000 firms in the whole world that make electricity for customers. If you have that limited of a market, you usually don't get price collapses down to the place where, you know, a lot of us can afford cell phones. So that leads you to the third, which obviously I prefer because I'm saving it for last, which is this idea of pricing in the negative effects of burning fossil fuels. And that's the idea that just simple accountability brings blessings. And the lack of accountability results in havoc. Climate change is that havoc. And so what if we just all paid for the space that we're taking up in the trash dump of the sky, like we do when you go to the city dump? You go to the city dump, or your trash hauler takes your trash to the city dump. They pay a tipping fee. Mm-hmm. And that tipping fee is there so that the city, when that dump is filled up, can build a new dump. Because otherwise, if you let people go and dump their, you know, the trash hauler dump his or her stuff in the dump for free, then what happens is the city is subsidizing that trash hauler. They're saying, oh yeah, it's free good, just come dump it. But if you charge them, and then they back that charge up to their customers, which would be appropriate, right? Because if they're hauling off my trash, then let me pay my percent of whatever it is that I'm taking up in the city dump. That's accountability. Mm-hmm. And then you know what I do? I start recycling some of my stuff. I start figuring out a way to reduce my cost. And so same thing about this trash dump of the sky. So you got to figure out a way to get accountability. But here's the big thing, Paul, is this, the hard thing is that here what I'm getting ready to describe is a carbon tax.
Mm-hmm. Edward.
Yeah, who in the world would want a tax, right? Especially a conservative. What conservative would talk about a tax? Well, I was just talking about one as a tipping fee. That's essentially a tax. It's a user fee, a tax. And most conservatives think that's a really good idea. And so in the case of the trash dump of the sky, what if we did the same thing? And we said, listen, we have only limited space up there. You got to pay for the space you take. And so we're going to put a tax on emissions. Well, that's a terrible idea. You know, that's going to make the price of gasoline go up and the price of electricity go up. Yeah, so let me quantify that. If you put on a $25 per ton price on carbon dioxide, mm-hmm. the price of gasoline goes up by 21 cents a gallon at the pump, at the local pump. Mm-hmm. And the price of electricity goes up by $11 per month in the average home. So now that sounds bad, right? That's particularly for poor people, that sounds bad. But what if at the same time you gave the money back? You did it one or two ways. One is by literally giving it back through a dividend check, like the Alaska Permanent Fund, where the government collects up this carbon tax and then it writes checks to the citizenry, returning to them that carbon tax revenue. Or what if we reduce the payroll tax, the FICA tax, that it actually is 12.4% all in for somebody working at McDonald's or somebody working at Microsoft. And if you reduce that tax and put on the carbon tax, the Congressional Budget Office says the bottom 70% of Americans end up doing better. But here's the other key thing, the key difference here, because I identified the problem with number one, the regulating, and the number two, which is incentivizing, is that neither get China in. But this carbon tax can get China in. And here's why. We'd collect that tax on entry of their goods into our ports. They'd object in the World Trade Organization, saying, you can't do that. That's an impermissible tariff. We'd defend using precedents in the chemical industry that say that you can have a content tax based on the content of the stuff coming in. And this would be a carbon content tax. If we're right and the WTO upholds our application of the tax, 24 hours later, because they do have an amazing way of reaching consensus, don't they, in China, China would have the same carbon tax. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they just paid on entry to an American port a tax on their goods that got sent to Washington. If they had collected that tax internal to China, the tax money would have ended up in Beijing and their goods would have come through the American port with no application of a tax. So 24 hours later, they've got the same price on carbon dioxide. Then the whole world's following, because you're doing business anywhere in the world, you're doing business with America and China. And so now you've got a global solution to a global problem.
Mm. Yeah. And you're putting a price, and going back to the original foundation of this, you're putting the price for the negative effects on those that generate the negative effects.
Right. Because as conservatives, here's what I think. You know, in the salad bar of life, take what you want, but pay for what you take. Mm. Right. If you do that, if this is what economists call, you know, avoiding the free rider problem, right? If you let people step off at the end of that salad bar without paying based on weight, well, you'll come back next week and all that'll be on the salad bar is iceberg lettuce, Thousand Island dressing, and some croutons. That's all the restaurateur will be able to afford to put on that salad bar, right? But if you get everybody to pay by weight, the restaurateur can have some sliced turkey, some nice olives, some cheese on that salad bar, because people are paying for what they're taking.
Yeah.
So in the salad bar of life, I'm for you having whatever you want.
Yeah.
But pay for what you take. Yeah. And then what happens is we all regulate our own appetites, right? Again, back to that regulatory problem. The problem with the regulatory thing is if you try to solve that salad bar problem with regulations, you got a guy with or a gal with a regulatory book at the end of the salad bar telling you, oh, no, you had mushrooms last week. You can't have them this week. No, you can't have sliced turkey this week. You can only have that every other week. You know, you get something like that going on. Well, what a clogged up system that would be. No, just step off the salad bar, pay based on weight, and then it's a very efficient allocation of resources.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I love your analogy of the salad bar of life. That's quite good, and I had not heard that before. So, Bob, let's take a short break. I like to do that for numerous reasons in the podcast. And one is to help listeners be refreshed through some good music. We'll have about a less than 2 minutes of music. And then when we come back, folks, we're speaking with Mr. Bob Inglis, the executive director of RepublicEN.org. It's a growing group of conservatives who care about climate change. And he's got some great ideas. Really excited to hear these again. So Bob, we'll be right back. Questions in Sustainability, and our host today is Mr. Bob Inglis from the organization RepublicEN.org, and one of his specialties is to as a conservative be able to talk about conservative solutions to climate change. And I don't know if I've ever shared with you, Bob, my own orientation tends on the liberal side. But I have to say, I think the ideas you present are very appealing to me, actually. So I guess that's an element of my own mixed characteristic and, with conservative leanings as well. So it's great to have you here, share this, and let's carry forward. So what...
And Paul, I might jump in right there and say, it's... If the solution that we describe at RepublicEN.org sounds familiar to you, it might be because it's the exact same thing that Al Gore has been for about 30 years. And that's, we might not start the conversation that way with fellow conservatives, because that'd be a little bit off-putting, right? But once we get through this initial discussion, as you and I have just had, then what I like to say to folks is, the goal here is to bring America together and lead the world to solutions. Mm-hmm. And I understand why my tribe, any tribe, needs to hear it first in their own language.
Right.
So they can make sure that it fits with what they deeply believe. Mm-hmm. And so we think we can clear that hurdle, because it's like if you want the people I'd put on the scene are people like Dr. Milton Friedman, who, the father of modern conservatism, actual conservatives know to sort of bow at the mention of his name, he was once on the Phil Donahue show. He says, Phil Donahue, a liberal, asked Dr. Friedman, who's dead now, but he says, what do you do about pollution then, Dr. Friedman, if you don't want to regulate it? And Friedman says, you tax it. You tax pollution. And then he goes on to explain better than I've just done this concept of internalizing negative externalities. In other words, negative effects of the burning of fossil fuels can be, or that's a negative externality. And you want them to be internalized, in other words, built into the price of products, so that with that kind of accountability, consumers, in the liberty of enlightened self-interest, will choose their self-interest, and they'll choose the cleaner products because they're actually cheaper once the dirty ones are taken to accountability.
Yeah.
So then you don't have to have a regulator at the shopping mall or at the grocery store. No, because we'll all be saying, hey, look, here's some wooden spoons. They're cheaper than those plastic ones right there. Mm-hmm. I think I'll get this wooden one.
The wood spoons, yeah.
And you know what? That happens to be some people in South Georgia will be making those spoons, or those forks, or those, and we'll be Isn't that great? Yeah. It's cleaner, it's cheaper.
Yeah.
And so once you bring accountability to all those emissions in that petroleum process, and so, wow, then, so the thing is, we think it's rock solid conservatism, but it's also true that it's something that Al Gore would say, yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I once asked an economist at Virginia Tech, a senior economist, in other words, a guy even older than me, I said, give me a name of an economist that I should read that would disagree with that kind of concept. He sat back in his chair and he thought for a few seconds. He said, can't think of one. Mm-hmm. He said, in fact, there isn't one. Mm-hmm. He said, you can't be an economist if you disagree with that idea. He said, it'd be like being a scientist and not believing in the scientific method. He said, doesn't exist. You can't be an economist if you disagreed with that. Mm-hmm. And so I know that sounds, in this age of political overstatement, it sounds like an overstatement, mm-hmm. but it really isn't. You can't find an economist who would disagree with that. And so that's why, if it sounds familiar and you find yourself from the left sort of liking that idea, well, it's because it's Econ 101 taught at University of Kentucky and every other university in the country.
Yeah, it's very, very appealing because it makes sense. It's, you know, just very clean and sensible.
Yeah, and clean is key because, mm-hmm. you know, here's the thing. The challenge of those incentives or the regulations, they really do get cumbersome. You know, I mean, and like I say, if I was still in Congress, I'd be voting some of those incentives. But they have expiration dates, and then you create a lobbying opportunity, and then, you know, it's just it's a lobbyist full employment act, basically all those sunset provisions. And so, but if you just put a price on carbon dioxide, mm-hmm. it's all of us then start regulating our own appetites. Right. We all start choosing cleaner because it's actually cheaper, not because we're trying to get good boy or good girl points, just because it makes sense.
Yeah. So you referred to that. I just want to be sure. I know we said it earlier in the program, but I just want to be sure to say it again. It's this is basically your proposal is a revenue neutral, border adjustable carbon tax, right? And so the carbon tax is the tax referring to. You pay more for using for having polluting effects on your purchasing decisions. But it's revenue neutral, in that it's returned in one way or another to the taxpayers, and border adjustable, with the whole thing about China imposing a similar price on goods from countries that don't have a carbon tax like we do. I don't think I've explained that very fluidly, but I just want, maybe you could just make sure that concept, revenue neutral, border adjustable carbon taxes, is well explained. So
you've got it. That's exactly right. That's you did very well with that. I think it's revenue neutral means you cut taxes somewhere else or dividend the money back. So there's no growth of government. We're conservatives at republicen.org. We don't want to be solving climate change as a ruse for growing government. Mm-hmm. Then it's border adjustable. You got to get China in on this thing, mm-hmm. and the rest of the world in. And actually, it's happening now. You can see this. This border adjustable thing. The EU is considering a carbon border adjustment, and anticipates doing that in the next couple of years.
So the EU. They might lead the way then, is what you're saying on that aspect.
Yeah, and so consider this. A couple of weeks ago, Russia announced that it was considering, therefore, a carbon tax. Mm-hmm. Why? Well, they import a lot of carbon fuels, particularly natural gas, mm-hmm. into the EU. And when they send that into the EU, they're going to be paying a carbon tax that's collected by the EU. But if they tax it themselves and collect that money and send it to Moscow, then the natural gas will come through that Nord Stream pipeline, for example, with no border adjustment. And so even the murderous organized crime syndicate that is Russia has figured out that this is a good thing. In other words, and my point is, if you can make Russia see the light, then surely we got a way to see, have the U.S. Senate see the light, don't you think? Yeah. I mean, you know, that really we're about to get a border adjustment applied to our products going into the EU.
Interesting.
Why don't we lead the world on this?
Yeah, so we're behind on this point of a border adjustable carbon tax. Well, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And so, but there's another important thing to bring up, Paul, because some of your listeners may not be as conservative as I am. And so for them, let me address something that's important, which is there's been some erosion of support for a carbon tax on the left because of the concern about environmental justice. And I think that's a legitimate concern. And we really do need to address the fact that poor people are dumped on. So I can't say that this carbon tax would solve all of that, because a lot of that is has to do with local decisions about zoning and where I can locate my polluting factory. The carbon tax does help with part of that problem, which is that, you know, I'm Inglis Industries and I dump on my neighbors. They're poor, they're disproportionately of color. They live in the cheap houses right near my plant. I dump into their lungs. And it's a pretty great deal for me, stinks for them. Mm-hmm. It's also pretty good for my customers, because I'm able to therefore sell a pretty cheap product, because I don't have to buy the best equipment to clean up my emissions. I just dump them out into the air and they fall into the lungs of my neighbors. But meanwhile, across town, there's a gal who has a different process, makes a similar product, but I beat her every day in the marketplace because I get to dump into the lungs of my neighbors.
Right.
Meanwhile, she doesn't do any of that. But I beat her every day. Stinks for her, stinks for my neighbors, great for me, and pretty good for my customers. You make me accountable through a carbon tax.
Yes, yeah.
You cause me to have to go buy that new equipment.
Yeah.
My price of my product will go up because I've got to cover that cost in my selling of my product, right? I got to increase my price. Well, at that point, my competitor across town is beating me and my neighbors are breathing better. And we've solved simultaneously the problem of climate change plus part of the environmental justice problem, which is that now my operation is cleaner and I'm not fouling the neighbors' lungs.
That's really interesting. First of all, I really appreciate you bringing in the social justice elements that you've described, and was not aware of the relationship with the carbon tax until just now. But I'm mostly going to promote this podcast episode to environmental groups and so on in Kentucky and beyond. So that's wonderful to have that element brought in. And so basically, I understood you to say the carbon tax won't fix all social justice issues, but it can help address some through allocation, more appropriate allocation of polluting effects than to just dump them in the properties of those that may not be able to afford a legal defense as easily. So it's very good.
Right. And of course, you know, some people would say to me, in fact, some libertarians have told me that, you know, better to handle this through the law of trespass. In other words, let those neighbors sue Inglis Industries for the harm that I'm doing. And that is actually biblical law that became English common law, that then became American common law, which is that I can't do on my property something that harms my neighbor's person or property. So that is a legitimate way to handle the situation. The problem for that is, though, I got better lawyers than the poor neighbors, mm-hmm. and I can bury them in litigation. Yeah. And so the chance of them successfully suing English industry is not real great.
Yeah.
And so, but it is, and it's interesting, you know, we all think of somebody like Milton Friedman as somebody that would be just into the economics, but he actually, in that 2-minute clip that you can see on the Phil Donahue show, you can hear the moral element of it as well, which is that it's just wrong mm-hmm. for me, in the example I'm using, to get away with dumping into my neighbor's lungs.
Yeah.
I should be held accountable for that. Just like, and if you think about the CO2 that I'm emitting, well, that's going to cause somebody in a Pacific Island nation to lose their home. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm part of that by my emissions.
Yeah, through CO2.
And so it's not just my immediate neighbors, the poor people that live outside my plant gate, but it's my neighbors in those Pacific Island nations whose land is going underwater.
And attention to these kinds of concerns is certainly something many conservatives would share, care for others, and so that's really good. One thing I wanted to point out is our conversation, that is the one you and I are having, is really a model for today's partisan world. And you're a gentleman. It's very easy to talk to you on that as a gentleman. But we're in such a partisan world today that I just wanted to point to this conversation as something where we listen to each other. And I like your ideas, even though I come from a somewhat different or ideological orientation. But your ideas are good, I think. And so that's, I can only hear those if I listen and respond.
Yeah. I think that it is why, even though climate change is a devilish problem, because you got to get the whole world in on it, maybe there's something good in it because we're literally all in this together. And once we figure that out, it may just model the way that we could solve or get towards solutions on some other challenges, like an enormous debt and deficit, like healthcare that continues to bedevil us, various international problems. It could be the thing that models the behavior that says, hey, folks, we really are in this together. There is no other that we can blame this on. We met the problem, and the problem is us, we just need to realize that and extend each other grace and look for solutions.
Yeah.
And I just pray that at some point we'll give up on this idea that we want politicians to be our gladiators. Mm-hmm. Who go slay the evil other side. I use an example in football. Here in South Carolina, those Clemson fans, they're the worst in the world. Oh, those USC fans, they're just the terrible. Well, I know a lot of USC fans and a lot of Clemson fans. I tell you, they're the same people. Yeah. There's no difference between them. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So but in politics, that's basically what it is. We say, oh, these Democrats, they're really terrible. Those Republicans, they're a bunch of capitalist pigs. And the result is, they're really all the same people.
Yeah.
And all looking for solutions that might actually work. And if we came together. Oh, and one example of that, by the way, I mentioned Al Gore. Art Laffer is another one of Reagan's economics advisors, in addition to Dr. Friedman, who I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Art Laffer is a neighbor of Al Gore's in Nashville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Art tells me he's been over to Al's house. Mm-hmm. They talked this through.
Yeah.
And they came to the conclusion that this thing of revenue neutral, border adjustable carbon tax works for both of them for very different reasons. Mm-hmm. Al, because he really wants to unleash the power of free enterprise to drive rapidly toward decarbonization. And Art Laffer of the Laffer Curve, because he desperately wants to untax income. Art says he's not sure. You can see on our website a 2-minute clip of him talking with me about this. He says, I don't know whether it's real or not, this climate change thing. He says, I don't really need to know. All I need to know is you're taxing income. You could be taxing pollution. Mm-hmm. He said, change what you tax. It's a no-brainer. And so what we say at republician.org is if we can bring Al Gore and Art Laffer together, we can bring America together.
Yeah. Interesting. Wow. Interesting, Don, about so many nuances. A couple things here before we wrap up. One, I did want to mention that the music track that I've chosen here for this episode, I like it because it conveys energy and optimism, which is what I think you bring and your team bring to the discussion on climate change. The last question is for the students listening in, and we may have middle school kids or graduate students and anything in between. What advice would you give for the students that might be listening?
Please be ambassadors to your parents and grandparents. That's what I'd ask them to do. Okay. Thanksgiving is coming up. Maybe your grandparents are going to be able to come this year. Bring it up. Talk about it. This is my friend Catherine Hayhoe wonderfully says, and she was there with us, wasn't she, Paul, in 2013?
Yes.
She says, the best thing you can do is just talk about it. And it's so true. She's so right. Just so at Thanksgiving, just take the opportunity to mention to Grandpa and Grandma that really what I'm learning at the university, Grandma, is that this is for real. Mm-hmm. Or what I'm learning in science in high school or in middle school, Granddad, is for real. And do you think we can find a way around this? Don't preach to them at the Thanksgiving table, maybe, but just ask open-ended questions and watch what happens, because Grandma and Grandpa love you and they want to be relevant to your future. They really do. They feel trapped. They feel maybe trapped by the way that they've carried on in life or something. Maybe they're coal miners. Maybe they were, connected to petroleum or something, or maybe maybe they're in a political party that has told them that this is nonsense. You're the one that can get through to them and say, you know what? Now that we know, can we do something different? Because when I was a kid, smoking was everywhere. You people would come over to your house and you were supposed to have ashtrays around for them to smoke. Can you imagine somebody coming in your house if you're not a smoker and smoking? It just doesn't happen now. It's like, I chew tobacco. You mind if I spit on your carpet? It's like, no, we don't do that, right? Because now we know. And so that's sort of the thing at Thanksgiving dinner is just say, Grandma, now we know. And can we do something a little bit different now? And then you'll watch Grandma melt, because it's a bond of love that's going to make it so that she can see a different way than what she's been seeing and hearing at her favorite news channel or whatever. You can help her break out of that world.
Yeah. Well, that inspires me to not only thank you, Bob, and which, I really appreciate your time, but also thank your son for finding a way to reach out to his dad and make a difference on this important issue. So, So Bob, thank you so much again for joining us. Mr. Bob Inglis, Executive Director of RepublicEN.org, a growing group of conservatives who care about climate change. Bob, thanks for your time, and I hope to see you again soon in Kentucky or somewhere else.
Let's do it. Yes. In person, I hope, soon. Thanks, Paul.
Wonderful. Thanks very much, Bob. And, to the audience, once again, you've been listening to Questions in Sustainability, a podcast on issues and challenges related to sustainability of food systems. My name is Paul Vincelli. I'm a professor of plant ecology at the University of Kentucky. And once again,